Welcome to episode 2 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks, political scientist at UNC Charlotte. And today my guest is Mike Allison, who is associate professor and chair at the Department of Political Science at the University of Scranton. And he also blogs at Central American Politics. So if you want to know anything about Central America, then you should start following his blog. Now, this being the first time that I had interviewed somebody, of course, I had to have audio problems right after I had tested everything. So what ended up happening was that I have an interview with Mike, and my voice doesn't come in at all. So what you hear are answers. So I'm going to bring in his answers and give him some context, because I can't stand the thought of forcing him to either do it over or throwing the whole thing away. And so the way that that I had started was by talking about Nicaragua, where we have Daniel Ortega, who is facing a presidential election on November 6th, and which he's going to win by a wide margin. And over time, but especially in the past year or so, Ortega has been centralizing power more and more. He's been blocking people from even being able to run for president if they showed even the slightest popularity, and bringing his wife into politics more as sort of this sense of a dynasty. And just bit by bit, he's really been dominating the political scene. So I asked Mike to start off with whether there were really any blocks on his power.
Well, you had the development of a Sandinista, anti-Sandinista bloc. You had the anti-Sandinista bloc was filled with some of the members who had left the Sandinistas early on, members of the business community, the church. And for the last 10 years or so, since Ortega has been president, you've seen the collapse of that anti-Sandinista coalition. And so the rise of Daniel Ortega, his family, and his immediate supporters has as much to do with some of the benefits, political and economic, that he's delivered as it has the collapse of all opposition to him in the country. Yeah, there is a bit of co-optation. Initially, and perhaps still, we thought it was as something unseen in other countries in the region that Ortega got along rather well with the country's business community through COSEP, and they were able to devise economic policies that were mutually beneficial. And so on the one hand, it was, you know, terrific to see a leftist or a more radical, perhaps, government in power work very closely with the business elites in Nicaragua, and for Ortega as well to navigate the complexity of maintaining good relations with the United States through the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and also with other countries of the left of Latin America through ALBA. And so his ability to navigate, you know, the minefields domestically and internationally were something to marvel at. I think in the last few years, we've been much more worried that he's either co-opted some of these groups, or the opposition has fragmented in such a way that there's very little check on Daniel Ortega's power in the country, or not just Ortega, but his wife and other his family members and other close confidants.
So I next asked Mike about the Nicaraguan right, because, of course, the right had ruled Nicaragua for quite a long time, having won the 1990 election that ended the Sandinista Revolution. So I asked him, well, you know, what's going on with the right? Why does the right at least seem to be kind of laying down?
Yeah, well, they were divided 15 years ago, 17 years ago, with Alemán and his presidency and his pact with Ortega as well. There's an element of they've in some ways stayed in the money-making business, and have, as long as Ortega is pursuing policies that do not infringe too much upon their efforts to make money, they're willing to work with Ortega right now. Yeah, I think, and something in El Salvador, the left always mentions, because a lot of the right wing in El Salvador that is criticizing governance or the lack of government, they're some of the biggest investors in Nicaragua. The right, in many ways, the economic elites in both countries, whether they're new or the more traditional oligarchic types, are much more interested in making money than they are getting involved in politics.
My next question then was, whether the Nicaraguan right even cared about ideology anymore. Because in the United States, we tend to be quite focused on labeling Ortega as leftist. But that it seems in Nicaragua, there's a lot more flexibility.
As Ortega is pursuing policies that do not infringe too much upon their efforts to make money, they're willing to work with Ortega right now. Yeah, I think, and something in El Salvador, the left always mentions, because a lot of the right wing in El Salvador that is criticizing governance or the lack of government, they're some of the biggest investors in Nicaragua. The right, in many ways, the economic elites in both countries, whether they're new or the more traditional oligarchic types, are much more interested in making money than they are getting involved in politics.
And next, he talked a bit about U.S. relations. And interestingly enough, saying, that the U.S. really doesn't have a whole lot of leverage over Nicaragua.
Yeah, the U.S. has little credibility when it comes to supporting democracy in Nicaragua. But we've had plenty of political figures in our country, whether they're in Congress right now or they've been in the White House, who've spoken out in a very negative way towards a country that has accomplished little other than to making relations between our two countries that much more difficult. There's little leverage that the United States has over the country. And I think really when the leverage that the United States has exerted at times recently in Guatemala and El Salvador, they've only been effective when there was a strong constituency in those countries that were in line with what the United States was pushing. Like when you think about anti-corruption efforts, and I don't think you have that opposition or that movement in Nicaragua that would sort of align with a stronger US voice.
I next asked Mike about the Latino Barometer poll, which just came out a couple of weeks ago, and what it really suggested was that support for democracy in Nicaragua was low compared to the rest of the region, and actually had been going down pretty consistently since he took office. And at the same time, there's the data seem to show that there's a good amount of ambivalence about democracy, that people were willing to accept non-democratic measures as long as the government was resolving their problems. So, I just asked them about, how much demand there was in Nicaragua for democracy.
How the Nicaraguan people are interpreting the question. Like when I think about whether or not we're thinking about democracy in Nicaragua or elsewhere being a lot about free and fair elections, I can understand why people sort of don't take that into too much consideration when they think maybe the government is doing a good or a bad job or how well they're resolving the problems. But when you start thinking about freedom of the press, freedom of association, all the other civil and political liberties that we might associate with democracy, I can't imagine how supportive the Nicaraguan people would be of a government that started to really restrict those other types of freedoms rather than the electoral ones, and I guess the checks on separation of powers that we see missing in Nicaragua. I don't know, it's just a more complicated question, I guess.
I brought up the question then about repression of the opposition, about whether there's the same kind of media repression that we see in other countries, that we've seen in Venezuela, that we've seen in Ecuador, and whether you see this the same sort of thing going on in Nicaragua.
Well, I don't entirely understand how the Nicaraguan people are interpreting the question. Like when I think about whether or not we're thinking about democracy in Nicaragua or elsewhere being a lot about free and fair elections, I can understand why people sort of don't take that into too much consideration when they think maybe the government is doing a good or a bad job or how well they're resolving the problems. But when you start thinking about freedom of the press, freedom of association, all the other civil and political liberties that we might associate with democracy, I can't imagine how supportive the Nicaraguan people would be of a government that started to really restrict those other types of freedoms rather than the electoral ones, and I guess the checks on separation of powers that we see missing in Nicaragua. I don't know, it's just a more complicated question, I guess. I think that there's a growing concentration of media power behind Ortega and his family and his supporters, but there's still a very active media environment in the country that is hypercritical of Ortega. They call him the unconstitutional president, and they've been very critical of him for the last few years, trying to investigate. I guess a canal probably is one of the big ones. Questions about the free and fair nature of the 2006 and 2011 elections, some of the municipal level results. So it's less pluralistic than it used to be, but still there is an opposition voice that's strong in the press there. No, but there were, at least I know with international reporters, there were some problems, particularly those who went in the last few years to investigate the building of the canal, that they were restricted from speaking to people who lived along the canal route. They were prevented from coming in or arrested shortly after crossing the border from Costa Rica into Nicaragua. And so I imagine that there was probably the same environment for local reporters as well, that is very difficult for them to get access to people who are going to be negatively affected by the creation of this canal. And then this year it moved on to academics, right? You had people from the United States who were being held up for apparently going into the country and asking questions. The one academic from somewhere out here in the East Coast, who was going in and asking questions. Representatives from Freedom House were found not to be welcome in the country. And last year there were concerns, I know at one of the meetings I was at, about the Ortega government only providing certain scholarships and grants to academics who are in support of the government. So there has been some stifling and efforts at stifling academic freedom and inquiry. That does carry over into the press, so it's a little bit of both. It's there, but I don't think you're seeing I don't want to, the level of violence and threats against the press in the country are not equal to the neighbors. But that doesn't mean that there isn't selective, that the Ortega government and its representatives will only speak to certain journalists. They'll deny other journalists access. They'll only give out publicity and place ads in outlets that they'd want to help financially.
Now, I was particularly disappointed because you can't hear the exchange that we had about the possible paranoia that Daniel Ortega has, because I thought, well, couldn't he just win? Why does he need to cheat? He's actually very popular. He's got like 66% chance of winning, or I'm sorry, 66% of people indicate that they're going to vote for him in the next election. He has high approval, and I thought it could be compared to Richard Nixon, because really Watergate came about because Richard Nixon was paranoid about losing, even though he was clearly going to win, and so it's a question of whether or not there's the same dynamic is at work with Ortega in Nicaragua.
That's what I've thought. You know, there was very little likelihood that there'd be any challenger to him in the November elections of this year. And so the idea that he needed to bar international election observers from coming into the country and he and his supporters to intervene in opposition politics just seemed to be overkill. And really done in a way that could threaten his ability to remain under the radar when it came to U.S. Relations with Central America. Again, as you started off saying, we don't hear too much about Nicaragua. And I think some of these actions that he and other supporters of the FSLN have taken, you know, really throw that into doubt as to whether that's going to be what we hear for the next year or two.
Lastly, I brought up the case of Mauricio Funes, the former president of El Salvador, who was very popular during his administration, yet now was being investigated for corruption. He came out with all these pictures of him. There's all these guns in his house, all this stuff, whiskey, children's toys. And so he managed to obtain asylum in Nicaragua. So I asked Mike about the dynamics of that and kind of why that happened.
Well, even before the FSLN, the FMLN, I think that relations between Nicaragua and El Salvador going back to the 1800s was often much stronger than each country had with the other countries throughout the hemisphere. So there's a nice story about this continuity of relations between Nicaragua and El Salvador that sort of made sense and carried over into the revolutionary years. But yeah, in terms of a Central American government that would be perfectly willing to take Mauricio Funes in and offer him asylum, Nicaragua is a likely destination. I believe he had a home there, at least, that he could also more easily set up shop to stay. He had some business activities in the country that gave him the cover to move into the country prior to officially asking for asylum. And it was a country who probably Ortega, you know, Mauricio Funes would not have any fear that Ortega would turn Funes over to any other government that requested his extradition.
And then he continued on talking about the coordination between the two countries, given their long history of cooperation, but also the history between the two ruling political parties.
Yeah, somebody told me that it was entirely approved by the FMLN. Funes is leaving the country and going to Nicaragua, that this would not have been decided without the FMLN and Ortega agreeing to it to take place. Yeah, I think the FMLN in El Salvador has, you know, they entered into a strategic relationship with Funes back in 2008, 2009 to win that year's election. They'd enter into a relationship with Funes and the friends of Mauricio. Over the years, over the 5 years that he was in office, it was clear that the FMLN and Funes were not always on the same page when it came to social, political, and economic reforms, perhaps even the gang truce. But the FMLN decided that their future was tied up into the performance of Mauricio Funes as president. And so even in 2011 and 12, when there became serious concerns about potential irregularities in Funes's accumulation of resources, the FMLN stood by him. And then he returned the favor, I'd say, probably in 2013 and 2014, as he constantly went after the former president Francisco Flores of Arena and attacked Arena incessantly over Twitter and the airwaves. And in government pronouncements, just attacking Arena, which helped the FMLN barely win the 2014 presidential elections. So the FMLN stood by him, you know, perhaps when they had the opportunity to distance themselves from him. But then he, in many ways, returned the favor and helped them defeat Norman Quijano in 2014. I think they're still together, right? They're still, the FMLN is not about to turn their back on Funes. I think they really had that opportunity a few years ago, and now they're stuck.
And with that, we wrapped it up. I guess the comment about being stuck is probably an apt one for Nicaragua, which for the time being seems pretty much stuck with Daniel Ortega. It's hard to see anything changing too much in the near future. And certainly the outcome of the November election isn't really in doubt. So with that, that is the end of episode 2 of the podcast. And I was talking with Mike Allison, who is associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Scranton. And again, apologies, especially apologies to Mike about the screw up with the audio, but at the very least, I'm glad that I was able to put together what he said. It was much better that I was the one who was cut off rather than him, because he had spent his time, giving us his expertise. And so with that, we'll end, and see you on episode 3.